Okay, so this week what I'd like to do is finish the series of, I don't know why it was called Walking in the Shadow of Giants, but I'm calling it Bridging the Gap, mostly for today's world. So what I'd like to do is start by reading some parts of it out loud. What page is that? Because I don't have a handout.
61,
okay. So on page 61 in the book Bridging the Gap, I actually want to read this section. So last week we talked about the homework. We talked about making our future happen for us and that we're in charge of it and how using Musar concepts can bring us towards that. I do invite discussion. You can ask questions all along the way. This does not have to be a lecture. So the homework for last week was to think about who am I now, who would I like to be, and how far apart are those two visions?
The answer is embarrassing.
So that actually, our Chachamim say, that is part of the fires of Gehenna, because obviously there's no such thing as a fire in Gehenna. It's a completely spiritual place. But the fires are the fires of shame that we will feel when we see who we could have been and who we actually are. Oops, that's me. Let me make that go away. So, right, so that is part of the fire in the next world. Sorry about that. As soon as this person goes away, I can turn it on silent.
That's going to hurt the show when it's played back.
Right. Yeah, sorry. That's the way it goes. That's how you know it's live. Okay. So what is Musar? We started out the class by defining Musar as the science that allows Torah to be absorbed into one's soul. So it's not its own study. And that's very important to understand, that it is, you can use my pen if you want for a little while. Okay, good. That it is the science that allows Torah to be absorbed. Now, the reason why I'm saying that, and that is the definition, is that it's very important to understand that Musar is defined many different ways today. And today, it's actually become, in a way, the new Kabbalah, meaning it's the new thing that people want is a separate study, separate from Judaism. So where it's not Madonna's Kabbalah, and the Kabbalah center of that, and the interest of mysticism separate from any kind of responsibility or personal growth, which is what the Kabbalah center is about, Musar really is saying, for those of you who want some personal growth, some character development, a lot of times Musar is defined as character development. For those people who are interested in that, come learn Musar. But the problem is it cannot be seen as a separate study. It is not character development. It is the science through which Torah becomes absorbed into the soul. So if you see it, and that does require developing one's character, but if you see it as character development, you're losing the point altogether, and it can't be separated. So that's why I wanted to read this section here, conclusion to section one, which is really what we were looking at these whole last 5 weeks. So I'll read this part out loud. Some 30 years ago, the situation in Eretz Yisrael was radically different from today. There were far fewer yeshiva students, and politically, the Haredim, they're what's called today the ultra-Orthodox, were a non-entity. The attitude of secular Israelis toward the B'nai Torah was condescending. They looked at the B'nai Yeshiva as primitive, unsophisticated, and uneducated. Instead of the fear or hatred that unfortunately often permeates today, there was simply a feeling of superiority. The secular looked down at the B'nai Yeshiva and they felt it. It was difficult to maintain their feeling as being the true elite of the Jewish world. It's interesting. We did discuss that more at length last time. It is interesting to see the difference in paradigm and what it was. In the creation of the initial creation of the State of Israel, it was created to be a secular state, and it was created by the secular.
When was this book written?
This book was written very recently.
Okay, so 30 years ago is roughly.
Yeah, some 30 years ago is 30 years ago now. It is 30 years ago from today. So let's say 1980s. When I lived there.
Maybe that's why the book's not published anymore.
No, I don't think so. A successful Jewish book is considered 2,000 copies sold. That's considered very successful.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. I mean, it's not successful. I mean, that's break even, but that's successful. A successful sale of a Jewish book is 2,000 copies. So it's a very limited market. And so usually a book like this is not printed 2,000 copies. They'll print 500 copies or maybe 1,000 copies if they think that it will do well. But they're not printing too. That's why it's not available, because they just test. Almost all Jewish books like this are pay to publish. So even if you are lucky enough to get a place like Feldheim to publish it for you, you usually have to fundraise to get your book published, at least some of the basic costs. So only people like Tzipporah Heller, Rabbi Wein, Rabbi Tversky, you know, those kinds of names can publish a book and know that they're going to make back the money and make it worth it. But otherwise, they're usually paid to publish.
Oh, we're talking about millions of Jewish people out there.
I mean, I'm talking about 12-ish million.
These books are new to me. Before I came to Aish, I didn't know anything about these
books. It's very... The Art Scroll Feldheim world is really small. Yeah, I mean, let's say out of the 12 million Jews, we have a million Shomrei Shabbos on the planet. Divide that into families, right? Because those aren't all adults, right? There's a lot of kids. So you're talking about
600,000, no doubt.
Right? So you're talking about a very small number of Shomrei Shabbos adults, and then how many are English speakers, right? And then how many are, you know, out of that market? Now there is an explosion of Jewish books.
Is Ari Kaplan one of those?
Well, he passed away a while ago. So his books were asked for. He wrote for NCSY. It's interesting to think about his books. He wrote for teenagers. So if you're reading any of his books, you can think about the fact that he wrote for teenagers. You can see the degeneration of the generations in reading his books that were written for teenagers, because today they're at adult level. So yesterday's teenager was a smarter type, and today's adult is dumbed down a little bit, so that it's not all such simple reading. Anyway, it was a different world. The State of Israel was founded to be secular by secular Ashkenazic Jews, and there was it was a threat when the Sephardim came from the Sephardic lands, from the Arab lands. They came religious, and they came uneducated, quote-unquote, meaning secularly uneducated. They often largely came also religiously uneducated, but religiously committed. So they didn't even have the religious education that could stand up in terms of quality to the secular education of the secular elite that were running the country. So there really was a huge pull. And the Ashkenazim who founded the country really were born of the Enlightenment. And so while they were strong Jews, they were very strongly secular. Not like today, where you're secular by default. They were secular by choice, by education, by contemplation, and by choice. So they clearly wanted a secular state, and they were doing their best to establish a secular Jewish state. So they really believed that that the transformation that began in Europe, the answer to the question of what can we do about this horrible condition of being Jewish, right? The persecution, the pogroms, the not being given access to education, to employment, to land ownership, to whatever it is, access to, and just fill in the blanks. There's so many of them. What is the answer to this state for the Jew? So there are a few different answers. The Orthodox answer was deal with it, right? This is God's will, and you can bear it, and there's a bigger picture, and you maybe don't understand the whole thing, but there's absolutely no way to leave tradition. You dig deeper into it, you hold on tighter. That's the Orthodox answer, right? The Reform answer was, well, maybe we want to be Jewish, but maybe we don't need all these trappings. It seems like quite a bit. Perhaps it's antiquated. Let's move into the modern age, dump most of it, be a Jew in the house and a man on the street, right, was their byword, right? Move worship services to Sunday mornings, throw in an organ, make the shuls like cathedrals, be clean-shaven, speak German, don't speak Yiddish, right? No yarmulkes, let's be a man on the street and a Jew in the house. So that was their answer. The answer that was offered by the French Revolution, by Napoleon, who allowed Jews, for the first time, to have civil rights within a country, So you could be a Frenchman of the Hebrew faith in France, as long as you renounced nationalism, Jewish nationalism. So as the beginning of nationalism throughout Europe, as long as you renounced nationalism and you were willing to be a Frenchman of the Hebrew faith, then you could have civil rights in France. So that was one answer too. Herzl's answer was assimilate. And he was the first one, it was about 1850-ish. It was the first time really that a Jew could. It was the first time anybody could be a nothing. Before that, you had to be something. And so the ticket for the Jew into the rest of society was to convert to Christianity. Basically, this was the first time you could just not be anything. And so Herzl chose that route. Now, it wasn't completely possible, not like today. But he did choose that. He didn't circumcise his children. And he didn't believe in Jews separating. They should just be a citizen of the country that they're from. There was no nationalism, no Zionism, no yearning for the return to Zion, which is something that Reform gave up, that Germany was the fatherland and Berlin our Jerusalem. That was one of their statements also. So Herzl's answer was just blend. And then when he witnessed the Dreyfus trial in France, and he saw that Dreyfus was, he was a journalist in Switzerland, sent to France to cover the trial. When he saw that Dreyfus was set up, framed, convicted, stripped of his decoration in public, and then the response in the French street was death to the Jews. Mm-hmm. He realized there's no assimilating. If in France, the first country that offered civil rights to the Jews, if that was the response of the French street, death to the Jews, he realized a Jew could not assimilate. It wasn't possible to become part of the society around them. And so his answer to the question changed. His answer to how do we get out from under this Jewish problem was no longer assimilate, but we need a state of our own. We need to take our place among the nations. We need to be a people like all other peoples, have our own government, our own land, our own army, and then we'll be respected, he hoped. Which is why he was willing to take Uganda. Didn't matter to him if it was Israel. It had nothing to do with a return to Zion, nothing to do with Judaism. Just the fact that he saw clearly that Jews can't assimilate. So the initial state was secular. He was overridden, of course, and Israel was the place, but the initial founding of the state was a secular state. And it was the secular elite, educated secular elite Europeans who wanted to found the state and were working on creating a project of socialism out of it and creating an equity and, all the things that they did, which led to negative things, too. There was a lot of sharing going on, money and wives, too. I mean, those kibbutzes were, nobody owned anything. So there was definitely a quest towards fairness, quote unquote. But it flowed from kohos atuma, from the negative powers, rather from the positive powers, which is what it has to flow from eventually. The Nefesh HaChaim says in some of his books, which I have not seen inside, I've just read commentaries on them, that eventually we do seek equality. There will be an equality among the Jews. Right now we have a Kohen Levi Yisrael system, a step-down system. But eventually there will be equality with Hashem in the center and the Jews surrounding Hashem as a circle, which is one reason why on Simchas Torah we dance in a circle around the Bima. That in a circle every point is equidistant from the center, and there is meant to be that equity among the Jewish people and not a tiered system. But we're in a temporary state of disconnect. And so for this state, however long it is, we do need that tiered system. But eventually we are headed towards that. So when the era of Mashiach comes, there will be that equality. Now it's interesting to see, the more you learn about those types of things, how during the sweep of histories we're getting closer to Mashiach. So there was certainly a European mindset of how could we shift towards equality. It came from kohos atuma, came from the negative powers, rather than from the positive powers. So eventually we do have to come to a place not of communism or socialism, or I think I mentioned in one of the classes, right, was it this one, about the comic of the two kids trick-or-treating, and they're in their costumes trick-or-treating, they knock on the door, and they both have huge bags of candy. Knock on the door, and the guy says, wow, looks like you kids have collected a lot. And he says, I'm going to take half of what you collected and give it to some children who didn't go trick-or-treating. And they say, rats! He's a Democrat! So, We do have to come up with a system where there's some level of equality, but that doesn't mean taking away from somebody to give to somebody else. It means giving everybody equal access. And so there are initiatives, certainly within American culture, that work towards that, equal access in education. We're not there yet, but we have concepts about it. So it has to flow from Kohos HaTahara, from the Tahor forces. Anyway, so in the initial state of Israel, the secular looked down upon the religious. The religious were very few in number and very weak, did not hold electoral power at the time. Now the religious parties have increased, and they do hold a large swing vote. They actually pretty much hold the swing vote in the Knesset, so that the Labor Party and the Likud Party, neither one is big enough to make their own majority. They require the addition of the religious parties. So the religious parties then have an inordinate amount of power in the Knesset, much more than they represent in terms of the electorate. So, but before that is when there's this attitude that was pervasive in society, that the religious are nothing and they're going to disappear soon. So in the face of that, next, second paragraph, a student of the revered Mashgiach, Rav Shlomo Wolbe, approached him with the following proposal. Why not publish articles introducing the secular Israeli public to some of the deep foundations of Mussar, a science rich in psychological and behavioral insights?
Excuse me, just
what is Mashgiach? Mashgiach is used in Kashrus. You probably recognize it from there. So it means overseer. So somebody who oversees Kashrus. In this case, it's the Mashgiach of a yeshiva. This Mashgiach is the overseer of the spiritual growth and development of the students. Mm-hmm. So they're often referred to as the Mashgiach, like the Rav. There could be a rabbi.
Is that a different person from the Rosh Hashiva?
Yes. Oh. Yes. So, yes, it is. So the Rosh Hashiva, I think the Mashgiach in the yeshiva here is Rabbi Poulter. But it would be his specific job to oversee the boys. And then so the word Mussar today, I was going to say, and then to give them Mussar. Today, the word Mussar also means to reprimand or to dress down. Mm. Right? So if a boy's walking around with his shirt untucked all the time, he'll be given Mussar, tuck your shirt in. I mean, that's not how a boy, you know, represents himself. Or if he's not showing up on time for minyan, he'll be given Mussar about it. So that's not the usage here in this book. But Mussar does have a negative connotation in the minds of many yeshiva people because of that. Because for them, the word currently is synonymous with reprimand, to be given Mussar. So even though people know that there is a science of Mussar, that there is a Mussar school, they could list you off some of the Mussar greats and some of the Mussar Sfarim, still, the same way the word awesome today means neat or cool, right, it still does have the connotation of awesome, but we use it so commonly to mean awesome that it's sort of lost its meaning, although its meaning still exists. So the same thing with Mussar. We're talking about true Mussar, but the Mashgiach who gives Mussar is reprimanding. To make it more complicated, he will also give the Mussar Shmooze. The Mussar Shmooze, often given typically on Wednesday nights in many yeshivas, it will be a almost an evangelizing speech. I mean, it is get you going, and sometimes fire and brimstone a little bit. Like, you know, you're gonna burn if you don't. Not burn in hell forever, but you'll feel the fires of Gehenna if you don't learn longer and do better and speak nicer and, you know. So that's the Mussar Shmooze. Also, it's not always this kind of information. So it can be very confusing. The word is used in a few different ways. Part of that is because classic study of Mussar, and if you see deeper into this book, he'll sometimes say that this is not our pathway today, but the classic study of Mussar did involve removing of negativity in sometimes painful ways. So some of the early Mussar exercisers would roll in the snow, purposefully give incorrect change to merchants so that they would be yelled at, so that they could experience shame and deal with the feelings. You know, the strange things that it's not our pathway at all. But some of Mussar is associated with those practices. So that's not how we behave. Anyway, Rabbi Wolbe, who was the Mashgiach, responded that we must never do such a thing. Mussar, he explained, is the science that allows our Torah to affect us. Divorced from Torah as a standalone entity, it has no meaning. True, it is a science with infinite depth and singular ability to reveal the hidden treasures that lay deep within man. However, its wisdom can only be accessed through living and learning Torah. The secular public would not, could not understand this, and thus they could never comprehend or appreciate Mussar. So I think the way that we can understand this today is Shabbos. So for anybody who's kept Shabbos or at least spent time in a Shomer Shabbos home or kept a Shabbos, they can see a difference from the experience to what it looks like on paper. Mm-hmm. Right? When you have it on paper, it's so many do's and don'ts. It seems like you're trapped in a bunch of laws. But the experience of Shabbos is completely different. Mm-hmm. And if you would try to tell somebody that all the don'ts create space and push the world away, and all the do's fill that space with the energy of Shabbos so that you can experience it, so they might be able to hear it a little bit more. That kind of organizes all the rules. Oh, that's interesting. It creates space and it fills the space. But until you've lived Shabbos, you have no clue, really, what the person is talking about. Mm-hmm. So the same with Mussar. You can't understand Mussar if you don't keep mitzvahs. It's not possible to apply it to your life. And there are different, I mean, he talks about later on in the book, getting to know yourself through your different midot, midot being measurements. It's often translated as character traits, but in fact, a midah is a measurement. So a measurement is how much of that character trait do you have, not necessarily which character trait is it. So a midah being the measurement. So getting to know yourself through observing your midot, and getting to know yourself through observing your feelings, emotions, and behavior in relation to mitzvot. So, for instance, if you notice in yourself that you're regularly late to shul, let's say you have an intention to be on time, right? So now you notice you have an intention to be on time, and you're regularly late. Both of those things can teach you something about yourself. Your value, intention to be on time. Regularly late, what does that mean? Why are you regularly late? Are you disorganized? Is your intention not actually true? What is holding you up from getting there on time? Do you enjoy sitting around and having coffee and reading the paper too much before you get to shul? What is going on? But whatever the reason is, you can learn something about yourself from the difference between your intention and your behavior. So, and if you don't have the intention and you're okay with being late, you can also learn something about that. Is the norm to be on time? It is. Why haven't I taken that on? What is it about me that doesn't care about not being there on time? So just in the observance of how you react to the mitzvahs that you're given, to the structure that's there in life, why you want to be part of it or why you don't want to be part of it, being the observer and then going deeper and questioning yourself about why that exists the way it does can bring you to self-knowledge. But without a mitzvah structure, then kind of anything goes. Just like on college campuses today, where they say, you know, what's good, really, and what's bad, really? I mean, within a context, couldn't Hitler be good? I mean, from his point of view, wasn't he ridding the world of what was bad? How could you really call that bad if he thought it was good? Who are you to say that what he thought was bad? Right? So we get to this relative, and I'm serious, people think that. You can come to this level of relativism, which makes everything meaningless, which is why Mussar can't really have meaning outside of a world of absolutes. There are absolute values in the Torah. Certain things are good and certain things are bad. So, and certain things are different levels. But unless you're operating in a world in which there are absolute values, you can't really observe how you interrelate with those values and those absolutes to be able to observe who you are and what you're trying to accomplish and why you're failing or succeeding in certain areas. So Mussar has to be taught and learned within the context of Torah and mitzvahs. Okay, so this next paragraph is crucial for us to understand this point. Mussar is never an end in itself. It's always a means of keeping Torah. It only has meaning through the struggle of observing Torah. This is its only goal, and this is the only way to access its strength. One who approaches Mussar for self-growth or to become a more developed person while remaining removed from Torah and mitzvahs cannot connect with it. Mussar has meaning only as much as it is tied to Torah, its sole aim being to strengthen our bond with Torah. It can never make us better people, only better Jews. Okay, So I felt that was important to read because so many people today are looking at Musar as just character development. And I want to be very clear that it's not. It's about making you into a better Jew and not into a better person.
But becoming a better Jew is becoming a better person.
Correct. But you could become a better person without becoming a better Jew.
No.
There are plenty of non-Jews who are wonderful people, who are kind and work on their kindness. You know, who are giving and work on being giving. Mm-hmm. You know, so there you can be, and you can work on becoming a better person within the context of that. So it could be tempting to see this program of Musar as a way to become a better person. Right? But so there is an overlap. But you don't have to be a better Jew when you're a better person. Yes, many of the ways, for a Jew, when a Jew works on his character to become a better person, he's often working within becoming a better Jew. But it's possible for a secular Jew to try to become a better person and have nothing to do with Judaism. Now, maybe it's cut flower values. Are you familiar with that paradigm, cut flower? So a flower grows in the ground, right? Grows from the ground. You sever it from its root, put it in a vase with water, and it looks great for a week or two, right? It looks like it's alive. And it is alive for a while, but it cannot regenerate
because the root is gone.
It's a nice,
so a cut flower Jew is a Jew who still gives tzedakah, still circumcises their children, still belongs to a shul, but doesn't really have Torah values, isn't really connected at the root, and so often can't pass it on to their children. Or even their children might be cut flowers. It does sometimes go a generation or two. But we see today that there are children of cut flowers or grandchildren of cut flowers who really are looking around and saying, no, I don't see it. I mean, for instance, a classic cut flower value, which is not Torah, but was definitely a strong value, roll the clocks back 30 years, Zionism, JNF, giving to Israel, planting a tree was a religious act, right? Where in the Torah does it say plant a tree? But planting a tree in Israel, I mean, for every simcha, right? For a wedding, for a birth, for a bar mitzvah, for a graduation, right? For a bar mitzvah, you planted a tree. It was a holy thing to do, right? And to support Israel and send money and put money in the pushka for Israel, to buy Israel, to support Israel, right? But that was a cut flower value. That value came from the love of Eretz Israel, because the land of Israel is the holy land, the land from which Torah emanates, the central point on the earth, the connector of three continents and an ocean so that the word of God can be spread by the people of God who live in a Torah society in that land. And so understanding that that piece of real estate was given to us by Hashem for the purpose of creating a Torah society, for the purpose of acting in a way that shines a bright light to the four corners of the earth through those three continents and from that ocean, and that we have to be there so that we can be the leaders of all humanity, that's really the Jewish value. But cut that flower and you get support Israel, right? Mm-hmm. With no roots, really. And now look at today's 20-year-olds. They're pro-Palestinian for crying out loud. I mean, like, you know, they're on college campuses and they really don't believe in supporting Israel. It's frightening. Mm-hmm. I have a son on the Boulder campus who goes to the weekly Hillel-sponsored Israel Cafe as the lone supporter of Israel. Mm-hmm. That's why he goes. Right? It's a Hillel-run event with all Jewish kids debating policies of Israel. And my son's the only one who supports Israel there consistently. And that's why he goes, is to be the voice that's pro-Israel at this all-Jewish Hillel-supported event. So that cut flower is no longer, right? So you have people like a Michael Steinhardt, bless his soul, who gives so much money to bring Jews to, he's the founder for Birthright, right? But he's a cut flower Jew, right? And so his passion is bring people to Israel. Once they touch it, they'll feel it. That's true for him. And it's true down to about 50-ish today, maybe mid-40s. But below that, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not the case that if you just touch it, you'll feel it. So, all right, so that concept of cut flower, right? So why did I bring that up?
You have to study and live Torah.
Right, right. So, okay, so let's look now here.
Muscle is only meaningful if you use it to learn Torah.
Right.
And to develop your roots.
Right, right, right. So you could become a better person, right, that was it. That a Jew could work on becoming, oh, right, that's right. So that's why a Jew could work on themselves to become a better person, but likely through cut flower things. Yeah. My father is a cut flower Protestant. His hands are never idle. Right, he's a hard worker. Mm-hmm. He wants to improve the world. He has a reforestation project and a recycling project and a teen center project and his coastal town in Oregon. And he's like busy with everything, you know, an environmentally correct house and, you know, whatever he does is like, but he's not religious at all. He believes totally that when you die, you're worm food, period, end of discussion. So why does he care? That's what he said. Those are his words, right? That's what he says. When you die, you're worm food. So why should he care if he leaves the world a better place? Because he does care. But that's because he's a cut flower Protestant, right? That's because his parents were strong believers and imparted to him a value of you contribute and you work hard and your hands will never be idle because idle hands do the devil's work. So he'll never say idle hands do the devil's work. Mm-hmm. But his hands will never be idle. He mm-hmm. saves little projects. If he's going to watch TV, even the news, he's got nails to sort or flies to tie or pennies to polish or whatever it is. He's got something to do. Like, he doesn't just sit there. So, but that's cut flower.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking the person who stands there at the Salvation Army kettle, that person is doing something good mm-hmm. because they're collecting money.
Mm-hmm.
And when I walk by, if I just feel, well, I ought to give something, I'm doing something good, but I may not be adding to my Jewishness.
Right.
On the other hand, if I walk by and I say, oh, an opportunity to do tzedakah, and even if it's not a Jewish organization, I know that I'm doing tzedakah as I drop in that coin
right.
or dollar, I may be feeding my Jewish roots.
That's true. However, specifically this example, better you should pass the Salvation Army bucket. And they do a lot of good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of the Salvation Army is salvation through Yashka.
Well, that's true.
So their whole, all their missions, all their food, all their shelters is all about get you fed and rested and warm so we can teach you the word. So that's the whole goal. That's why it's the Salvation Army. So, and my grandparents supported it tremendously. I mean, they were very big into it. So I feel terrible not, and yet it is antithetical to Judaism. It's not the Jewish message.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard, but that probably should be passed. But when you give to some other tzedakah, ARC, you should feel, this is a tzedakah, and I am giving tzedakah in order to benefit those people who need whatever they need. There are other things in research for a disease or whatever it is. Yeah, those are tzedakahs. The ballet is not. It may be a 501c3, but it's not tzedakah. I don't know why people think it is, but yeah, it's not. Okay, so let's see. I know there's probably another page that I want to show here first because I want to talk about nefesh. You know, it's interesting that the previous recording didn't come out, and I was trying to think, is it because I shared too much? You know, sometimes certain Kabbalistic things should be shared, and sometimes they shouldn't. Sometimes they shouldn't be on tape. So I wasn't really sure why it didn't, and I don't know if I want to share all the same things here. But I do want to share some things. So let's see. So Hashem should just guide me to share what's right and not what's beyond.
Is it the statement from Rabbi Salanter?
Well, so I want to share this. So the concept here is learning like a lamdan, understanding more, and engaging yourself with the learning. So that's what I wanted with Hanukkah. And it is a different energy. It's not Hanukkah today, so I can't really talk as much about chinuch. But
definition of a lamdan.
Lamdan. Okay, a lamdan. It just means a learner, really. But here it doesn't. Here it's been given specific connotation to learn broader. So I'll give you an example, and actually she gave the example in the end of this report on NPR. So yesterday on NPR, there was a report about Fosamax, the drug Fosamax, and how it's there to help prevent strengthen bone density and prevent osteoporosis. So when Merck or Pfizer, whatever the drug company is that developed it, they wanted to create a market for their new drug. But the bone density scan machines are expensive. So they went to the bone density scan manufacturers and said, what if we make smaller, lighter, cheaper machines so we can put them in all the doctor's offices so every woman can be scanned, so more people can be diagnosed, so we can sell more of our drug, mm-hmm. right? So, so they twisted it around inside themselves that this is helping women, which maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. It was definitely about creating a bigger market, right? And so they did get these machines developed that test more easily, cheaper, in more doctor's offices. However, they diagnose osteoporosis and osteopenia, which is propensity to osteoporosis, which also now is medicated. Mm-hmm. So now you've created a larger market. So as she tells the whole story and all the intrigue and all the machinations and the different sides of the story, are they helping women? Aren't they helping women? Are they just creating a market? Are they? Does medicating for osteopenia actually reduce fractures? It doesn't seem that it does. So should you be exposing women to more medication? If you're not actually preventing fractures, it does improve bone density, but is there evidence that there are fewer fractures is a question. Is not a question. It doesn't reduce the fractures. So should they be taking the medicine? So as she finishes the story, she says, I'm telling you the story of one drug, but it's the same story for a lot of other drugs, that a lot of drug companies, in order to increase their market, change or expand the definition of the condition that needs this drug. They lower the amount of cholesterol that's okay so that more people have high cholesterol, so that more people will take the meds, right? What is the impact on us as we medicalize many conditions and increase the drug taking of our society? So that's learning like a lambdan, is to say, I heard one story, but I bet it exists in other places too. This is one paradigm. I just heard all the ins and outs of Fosamax, but it exists in cholesterol, in high blood pressure, in diabetes, in depression, in whatever. You can name a lot of them, right? Learning like a lambdan is hearing one thing and opening it up and not just thinking that it's the one thing, right? That it's a paradigm for something and understanding that the one thing that you heard about means other things too.
So is that positive way of thinking, or
yes, that's a positive way of thinking. No, it's a positive way of thinking. You should be thinking more. So you should be thinking broader all the time, making connections and thinking broader. So
the example with the pharmaceuticals,
right? You should hear that on NPR, and then she said it. But if she didn't say it, you should think to yourself, "Huh, I wonder if this exists in other parts of the market too." Interesting. Seems to me it would be possible for this to exist. So certainly if you were studying it, right, whether from an anthropological point of view or from a finance point of view or from a medical point of view, there's all different points of view to look at this phenomenon of drug companies trying to increase their market share and sell more drugs, right? So there's lots of different ways to understand this. But learning like a lambdan means look at the thing and then broaden it out. Don't just see that thing as the one thing. So, and a lot of times people, I think the opposite might be, although I'm not sure, I haven't thought it out clearly, might be being a dafkanik, right? Because a dafkanik is somebody who looks at one point and stays on that one point, right? Splits hairs. There is no good translation. Mm-hmm. I know that I am one, though, because my mother, when I was a little girl, used to always say, you should be a lawyer. You split hairs. They used to call me their New York lawyer, so as a little girl. So because that is somebody who stands on principle, but sometimes just on the principle. Like, I'll give you a good example of a dafkanik, right? So I was in the bungalow colonies in the Catskills. It was a rainy day, Erev Shabbos. I had four little kids, and my husband wasn't there. And I had just cleaned the bungalow from all the mud, put the babies in new stretchies, right? And a little 7-year-old girl comes and knocks on the door who wants to play with my eldest. Her feet were caked in mud. I told her, stay right there. Do not come in. I said, your feet are so muddy. She said, my feet are not muddy. I said, look at them. She said, my feet are clean. My boots are muddy. Right. So that's a dafkanik. So I was trying to communicate the principle that you had mud on the ends of your legs. Don't come into my bungalow.
Right?
D-A-V-K-A, Dafka, N-I-C-K, Dafkanik.
So were you the Dafkanik, or was she?
She was the Dafkanik, in that case. She was being the Dafkanik, right.
But it's interesting because she completely missed the point.
Correct.
Of the intervention.
Correct.
And yet she was correct in her detail.
Yes. Exactly. So I think that's why I'm saying that is, thank you for saying that. I think that is why I was calling it the opposite of a lamdan. Because sometimes people stand on details and they don't get the bigger picture that this detail portends, that it does lead to something bigger, and you need to learn to think in a bigger way. So don't just think, oh, I have a problem being late to shul, right? Think, I have a problem with honesty in my desires, right? What does that mean, right? It's much bigger than that. It's not just being late. If you say, I just don't show up on time, that's just who I am. Well, what is that? Is that you don't respect other people in their time? Is it that you don't care about the thing? Is it what? Why? Why are you late? Mm-hmm. Or is it that you're so disorganized? I mean, but is there a reason for the disorganization? Or what's the reason for the disorganization? Isn't it organic? Is it mental? Is it spiritual? What's going on here?
It's the ability to generate questions.
Mm-hmm. And to see it bigger. It's not just the generating of the questions, but it's the knowing that there are things that are attached to this and being able to open it up and look and find them. So it's the ability to ask Jewish questions, I have to say. You know, I remember when I first started learning like a lamdan. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first started learning a Mishnah at Bravender's. So even Pirkei Avos, whatever Mishnah it is, they would always say, well, what's the difference between the first half of the Mishnah and the second half? And first of all, I couldn't see that at all, that there were two halves. No, I really didn't. And once I finally could see that there are two halves, and they'd ask questions like, you know, what's the difference between the first two, or why are these two connected, or why does the second half follow the first half? I would never would have thought of those questions at all. Like, it just didn't even occur. I just read it, and that's what the rabbi said. Next, you know, I just would totally receive it, rather than wondering about it. Mm-hmm. And it took decades to learn how to wonder properly. And that is learning like a Jew, is learning how to wonder, what's going on here? Why does it say this here? Some of it's literary analysis. And since I didn't finish high school, I didn't get that level. I went straight to yeshiva after 10th grade. So I didn't get, you know, junior and senior year of high school and literary analysis, really. So I just missed that piece of development of education. I didn't have that to apply. But it was also just the fact that there's Jewish questions and you have to learn how to think differently when you're learning like a lambda.
The Talmud study is that, you know, trying to learn how to ask questions.
Correct. It is. Right. Rather than just hear what it is, but hear where are the holes?
Yeah.
Why doesn't this make sense? Why is it in a different grammatical tense than it was before? Mm-hmm. Why did one rabbi ask the question and another rabbi answer it? Are they from two different generations? Are they from different points of view? Like, did they exist at the same? Like, oh, there's so many questions. Mm-hmm. And you do have to learn how to ask them. That being said, let's look at Nefesh. What time is it? I have a million watches and none of them have batteries right now. 7:48, good, we have time. Excellent. Okay, so.
So you have to ask yourself, why is it that you don't go to the store and get...
Well, so I know, and my son actually, he looked at me. I said, I'm going to Israel in February. I know where the battery store is in Israel, and I'm just waiting until I get there. I went through all my watches, each one, and they died, each one, like right, 2 weeks after another one. I was wearing my Shabbos watch, it died. So he looked at me and said, Ima, you haven't gotten a new watch battery in this country since 1980. I think it's time to expand your horizon.
That's called a battery plus.
Right, but I know where to go in Israel. I just don't know here. And I used to go to Target once in a while, but they don't do watch batteries anymore. So somebody did tell me Walmart, so maybe I'll try that soon.
I'll do it for the watch if you bought it there. If you didn't buy it there.
Right, so, and I'd feel like, you know, I'd feel a little wasteful too, because these are like, most of the watches are $9 watches. Like, you want to put a $7 battery into that? Not really. I'd rather put a 5 shekel battery into it, you know? So, we'll see if I get one replaced maybe before I go. Okay, so Nefesh. Here I want to confuse you a little bit. So, I'm going to tell you the three different definitions for the word Nefesh. And I know that there's a specific point in why I'm doing this, but I don't have that exact point right here. Page 28 does have about exciting the nefesh. So when we learn, our goal is to excite the nefesh, and I was hoping that it had. Okay, so we are talking about learning like a lamdan, exciting the nefesh. I just want to read this paragraph here on page 28. The Torah demands that we actively consider and challenge ideas. This is true both of ideas. This is page 28, right? I think you have it, but I'm not sure. Maybe I'm just reading it. Maybe I didn't copy it for you.
Page numbers aren't on here.
Yeah, so maybe I didn't copy it for you.
I don't know.
I don't even know if I did or not.
That's one of the reasons why scanning
right.
is better.
Right, yes it is. Next time I will learn my lesson. Okay, so I'll read you this paragraph on the top of page 28. The Torah demands we actively consider and challenge ideas. This is true, both of ideas we have not previously encountered and those that we already know. Do I really understand this idea? Do I agree with it? What are its practical ramifications in my life? Why might I have difficulty accepting it? If one appreciates Torah study without acting, if one approaches Torah study without asking these types of questions, his Torah knowledge will not truly penetrate his being, and he will never reach the level of study advocated by Rav Yisrael Salanter. The most sophisticated of ideas may stimulate our intellect, but without proper nurturing, they will remain solely in the realm of the intellect and will never be able to truly affect us. So there's a lot of important stuff in this paragraph here. But actively considering and challenging ideas is integral to Jewish learning. And so that's why I wanted to teach you about this concept in nefesh here. So, nefesh. There's a few different definitions that I'm going to give you. There's a definition of the Kabbalists, and there's two, actually, within that. And the definition of the Rishonim and the Baalei Mussar. So we have an A definition and a B definition on our sheets here. So the Rishonim and the Baalei Mussar, the Rishonim are the early 1100s, about. The teachers who existed around then. Rashi, Rambam, Ramban are the Rishonim, among others. The Baalei Mussar are actually quite a bit later. Baal, meaning owner of, master of, like Baal Tshuva. So Baalei Mussar are the authors of the classic Mussar books. So that would be the Ramchal, Rav Yisrael Salanter, people like that. And those are actually much later. We're talking 1700s, 1800s, basically. And even into the 1900s, I think probably the era of the Baalei Mussar ends with... Well, probably technically ends with Rabbi Wolbe, who passed away recently, in his book Al Eshor, but he would be a later Mussar. So he's not considered a Baal Mussar, but his book, the Al Eshor, is a very important Mussar sefer. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is in the era of the Baalei Mussar and the Ramchal. So the definition of nefesh, of the Rishonim and the Baalei Mussar, is that area of our soul in which our drives exist. We'll put it that way. As we talked about in an earlier class, that Hashem created the Torah, and he created the Yetzer, and he created the Torah as its spice. So the Yetzer, we know that the Yetzer comes in two flavors, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. Right, but in that phrase, it says Hashem created the Yetzer, and he created the Torah as its spice. Is that ringing a bell for any of you when I discussed it earlier? So the Torah as its spice means it flavors, it directs, it channels the Yetzer, right? So that energy of the channel of the drive is in the nefesh. The Kabbalists, though, talk about the nefesh as a life force, an energy. We'll leave it at that for just a second, and we're going to look at the neshama. So that's why I wanted the whiteboard, but I can just draw a nice picture for you here. So the question is, how is the neshama attached to our body? So this is through the Kabbalists we're now looking at. So this is specifically taken, this material that I'm about to share is specifically taken from the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, in his book Derech Hashem, The Way of God. This is generally accepted material today. The Ramchal was controversial in his day, but only really because he lived just after the era of Shabtai Tzvi. He taught about 50 years after Shabtai Tzvi died. So there were still Sabbateans who were waiting for resurrection of Shabtai Tzvi. And it was such a huge debacle in Europe that they really couldn't afford, the rabbis couldn't afford for there to be another messianic figure to come. It would just destroy the Jews if there would be another rise and fall like that, because it was such a huge fall. So when it became known that the Ramchal, at age 24, whatever tender age he was, maybe even younger, 21, was already leading a study group where, in order to be part of his group, you had to review the whole, I can't remember if it was the whole Mishnah or the whole Torah, every month. That was your personal commitment, and they were studying deeper things. And one of his students, who loved being in the Ramchal's learning circle, wrote home and said, "I am being taught by an amazing master. He's so amazing, he's taught by angels." Mm-hmm. When that letter fell into the hands of some of the rabbis, they said, "Oh, taught by angels? We're not interested." And they actually put the Ramchal in cherem and burned his books. But that he has stood the test of time. And today, pretty much everybody accepts him and his teachings as mainstream teachings, even though they're a little bit more out there. He's definitely considered a mainstream 100% guy. I don't know of any significant stream of thought that challenges his teachings. So he explains that the soul is the soul, what we call neshama. I should write it for you. Neshama. What we refer to as the neshama actually has five levels. The first level is called the nefesh. The second is called the ruach. The third is called the neshama. The fourth is called the chaya. And the fifth is called the yachida. Nefesh.
I lost you. I was
ruach. Neshama. Chaya. Yechida. Now, these levels of our soul all serve different purposes. I don't know all the different purposes, but I'll tell you what I do know. But to make matters a little bit more confusing, there's the way that this neshama is connected into us is through our nefesh. So there's another nefesh. And that nefesh is connected into us by our blood. This is a vein, that's a drop of blood. So this nefesh right here, this lower nefesh, is our animal soul. Mm-hmm. Animal meaning animate, what gives us life, right? So just like an animal has a life force that will leave it if it gets killed, a human being also has a life force that will leave it if it gets killed, right? That's different than the neshama. The nefesh, this lower thing, is actually physical. It is the highest and most ethereal level of the physical. Disappointing to dog owners, that I mentioned in the last class, is that animals don't actually have souls and they don't go to heaven. So they have expression and they can have relationships with us. But it's interesting to note, certainly within, let's just pick a dog, because I think that is a pretty high level of emotion in an animal. A lot, you can read a lot in their face and a lot in their attitudes. When you see that, and you know that all of that, the curiosity, the shame, the pleasure, the fidelity, that all the fear, that all resides in the nefesh, in the animal soul, you can begin to understand a little bit of how we Jews look at what is in the nefesh of the human being. All of that is in the nefesh. It's not part of our human soul, our spiritual soul. Mm-hmm. Our spiritual soul aspires to higher things than that. But the regular emotions, even basic love, is part of the nefesh, not part of, interesting, is part of the nefesh, not part of the neshama. So.
So that's nefesh.
So desire, even a lot of desire. It may be desire for improvement, those kinds of things. Even probably self-awareness is all here in the nefesh. So there's different levels depending on different animals, how much they have. But in that sense, we are an animal. We're part of the animal kingdom, and we have this animal soul. It is to this, and it's the most, this nefesh is the most ethereal of all physical things, but it is physical. So when an animal dies, it's gone. There is no soul to an animal. But confusingly, we do use the word soul and nefesh interchangeably. So for this purpose, nefesh is the life force that's connected to the blood. That's how this nefesh, this neshama, is connected to the body, to the human body, is through this lower nefesh. So really, can draw the circle kind of like that. This is the whole soul. We'll make this into a little chain. But that's how it's connected. So when this slips away through death, and that slips away, then it severs the connection of neshama to the body. Right, so then the neshama goes on to its eternal existence. The body is then a lifeless hulk, right? Completely different. But what actually gives the life energy is the nefesh, not the neshama. Mm. Now, that being said, what are these levels? Nefesh means rest. Nofesh is a vacation in modern Hebrew. Mm-hmm. So it means rest. So nefesh is that part of the soul that rests up against, so to speak, the physical body. That's the part that sits in the body. Going up another level, the neshama is usually the highest level that any of us can feel. We usually can't sense the higher two at all. We sometimes are influenced by the higher two.
What happened to Ruach?
We'll get there. But we usually can't sense them at all. Neshama is the highest level we can usually sense, and that's not even always. Maybe Yom Kippur and Ne'ilah or something like that, when we're really feeling strongly, or those few moments, you know, occasionally you see that sunrise on the top of the mountain, you just feel like, oh, such a geschmack, like you just want to jump into all of creation and become one with all of it. That's your neshama, really, talking. That's this middle level, right? So this, the neshama is what strive to be united with the divine. We don't always feel that feeling, but it is there. We do feel it often enough that we know that's definitely a part of us. Right? The ruach, what does ruach mean?
Wind.
And?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit. Good. Excellent. Spirit. So when we sometimes use the word ruach to mean soul also, but for sure spirit and also wind. Wind is unstable by nature. It blows. The ruach here mediates between the nefesh and the neshama. The nefesh that rests up against the body, and the neshama that strives upwards. And the ruach goes back and forth, mediating between the two. I don't really understand that much more about this, so I can't really explain to you that much more about this. This is a basic framework. That being said, however, what about these upper two levels, just for a minute?
So can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the ruach is our connection, is or isn't.
No, the ruach mediates between those two forces. It's kind of, it's theirs between the resting and
okay.
Being
no,
in place.
It's not a random win. It's kind
oh,
of
no, it's a deliberate mediator. Back and okay. It's like the liaison between being a spiritual being where everything is kind of okay. It could be even complacency. It's possible.
I thought you said unstable, and maybe that's
it is good. Unstable because it goes like that. Right? That's not necessarily stable. If something's going back and forth, a ferry is not stable, even though it has a route. A ferry that brings people, a boat that carries people from an island to a mainland. Sorry, different kind of ferry.
Not Tinkerbell.
I'm thinking about the ferry that I was recently on, right? A ferry that carries people, right? Ruach is kind of like a ferry, right? It brings back and forth. Right. It's not stable because it rocks in the water.
Right.
And it doesn't
okay.
stay in one place.
Oh,
it goes back and
yeah.
forth, right?
Yeah.
So it does have a route, right? I wasn't talking about that, not Tinkerbell. It does have a route that it goes along. But it's not stationary, certainly. It's dynamic. When I say stable, I mean the opposite of dynamic. Dynamic meaning it moves.
Oh.
It's all over the place, right? Whereas stable stays in one place. Nefesh would be more stable.
Mm-hmm.
Neshama is more striving, pulling everything upwards, whereas Ruach mediates between the two. Okay, so Chaya and Yechida are these two levels here. These two levels are the levels that can detach from us and bring us into out-of-body experiences, into information and dream states, into psychic awareness, which I think can happen, psychic awareness I think can happen on lower levels as well, but Chaya and Yechida would be parts that interact more with prophecy as well. And again, I do not understand very much about this at all. But what I can tell you that I do understand so far is that these two can detach, not all the way, but can detach, sort of like kites on a string, and go traveling on their own while we're sleeping. Mm-hmm. So while we're sleeping, and these two pieces of our soul can travel, they have two. There's two aspects to them. One is, how long is their kite string? And two is, where do they have visas on their passport? Into which realms may they enter? Mm-hmm. So the length of the string and the visas in their passport, so to speak, are both dictated by the behavior of the person that they are attached to.
So what's the question here?
Where can they go? What can they access? Which realms can they access? What information are they privy to? Which spiritual experiences can they experience?
So you need to strengthen or to work on your nefesh in order to get it, you know, better than just the animal, but you control. I mean, so you have a desire for food, so you need to control that desire. If you can control that, that strengthens that part of the soul, but that then allow all the, then the neshama can strive farther, and the...
Right, if you can, right, good, if you can allow...
To go up farther.
Right, if you can allow your neshama to be really the ruler, kind of, to mm-hmm. dictate what your body does,
right.
If you can work on yourself so that you have a sensitivity that allows you to hear the strivings of the neshama and respond to them, that's mm-hmm. the hard part, because we often hear it and say, go away, I'd rather read the New York Times than daven. You know, so the neshama might be saying, could you get up and pick up a sitter? And the goof is saying, but this news about the health care reform bill is really interesting, right? So not only do you have to be able to hear it, but you have to train yourself to function according to it. The more you function according to it, the more choices you make positive, mm-hmm. The more latitude and the more visas these get. And the less, the chaya and the yechida,
the two highest
ones. The more negative choices one makes, the less latitude these two have. The less they can accomplish at night when you're sleeping. That is one reason why when we wake up in the morning, we are careful to wash our hands. So in the morning, when we get up, there is a special tumah that is unique to the morning and waking up, which is very, very tamei. And the reason why it's so tamei is because part of our soul has left our body while we slept. So sleeping is like being 1/60th dead. When we say 1/60th, the number 160 here, 1/60th, does not mean an exact fraction. It means a part that's perceptible but not totally perceptible. Mm-hmm. Right? That's why it's nullified in kashrus. 1/60th of a treif ingredient in a kosher pot leaves the food in the pot still kosher. Above 1/60th, it is not. Right? So.
But if it's more...
If right, above 1/60th, it's not kosher, and if it's below 1/60th, it is still kosher. So it is something that's perceptible, and yet not a critical mass of the object in which it finds itself. So we say sleep is like 1/60th of death.
Is there any correlation with stages of sleep? You know, stages 1, 2, 3, 4, electrocardiogram findings and such?
I don't know, but I would guess that deeper sleep is where these kinds of trips happen. But I don't know for sure. But that seems to make sense. Well, the dream stage is the deeper sleep stage?
Yeah, actually, it's not such a deep stage.
Uh-huh.
It's a more superficial stage.
So that makes sense then.
But there's a cycle, a 90-minute
right.
cycle. And
so it makes sense that these would be on their trips during the deepest stage because they affect your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
When you dream, most of what we dream is narishkeit. It just means nothing. You're just either processing what happened in the day, or processing the food that you ate, or just thinking about things occasionally, or just nothing, right? Occasionally, little threads of meaning are actual in those dreams. Hardly ever is a dream completely meaningful. That's very rare. That would almost be prophecy if the whole dream was meaningful. Usually it's just threads. But those threads actually would be obtained from the trips of the Chaya and the Yechida, and then come down through all these levels of the soul, and then into the nefesh. And I think we dream in this lower nefesh, not even in this nefesh. But the actual dream happens here, in the physical, because animals dream too. You see dogs, like, dreaming about running, or, like, you know, you see them dreaming. So the dreams happen in the animal part of us, but is influenced by the spiritual part of us. So until the information that the Yechida was able to obtain filters down through all these levels, you don't even know if... Very few people are able to be aware of the fact that it came from here. You might feel that it came from here, neshama level, but you hardly ever will feel it from here. So, and that would only be someone in a very developed spiritual level. So it's not, but it doesn't mean that we don't get those effects. We just don't perceive its source. We might perceive it as the neshama source.
Yeah, you need some kind of form to interpret it.
Right, usually you do. We just, by the way, we Jews are very careful to interpret dreams. So in case anybody ever tells you a dream, you should know that the Jewish way to interpret is always positive. So even if somebody comes to, because our words make a difference, and they can spin a tale in different ways. So when somebody comes to you and says, I dreamt I got in a horrible car accident and my leg was amputated, then you can say that means you're going to win a race to whatever it is. It means that you use your capacities, even when you feel like you don't have enough, to really accomplish what you need to accomplish, and you're going to live through everything that comes your way. You know, you just have to stay positive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even always have to connect, but you say positive. You don't say negative when you interpret a dream. So, because our words do make a difference. We do create with our words. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I taught you all this about souls. Any questions so far? Okay, so one reason why I taught you this was to give you information about souls. And another one was to remind you that when you learn something, you have to actively consider and challenge the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Keep learning it.
You have to think to yourself, do I really understand this idea? Why is it nefesh? Why do we use the same word nefesh three different times? What is it about that?
What was the third?
The way that the Rishonim and the Bali Musar use it, which is the seat of our drives.
First was drives, then life force, and then I was waiting for the third.
Oh, so the third is in this neshama thing. Life force is, so the third is this. So you have, first is the Bali Musar, second is this nefesh right here. Third is this nefesh right here, the lowest level of the neshama. Mm-hmm. Right, so according to the Kabbalists, right, the lowest level of the neshama. So the Kabbalists use it in two different ways. The Bali Musar add on a third way. Why do we use the same word three different ways? I'm not answering that question. I'm just telling you, you should be asking it, right? Mm-hmm. So that I don't want you just to be receiving information here. You need to start asking questions. I can't answer all the questions for you, but I do know that you have to start asking questions.
That's why we are rabbis.
This stuff is very abstract.
Yes. So, on the one hand, yes, it's true. That's why we have rabbis. And on the other hand, no. We should not be asking questions and just listening for answers. This will not bring us to a place of greater knowledge. How many times have you asked a question, gotten an answer, and then you can't remember what the answer was?
I always remember the answer.
Or the question.
Or the question.
I remember the answer and the question.
That's good.
Then I can repeat to somebody else.
Uh-huh. That's good. Repeating it to somebody else is actually a very important part of the learning process. Actually, it is something that we are supposed to strive to do, is to learn information and then repeat it to somebody else. Because the repeating process is what brings us to actually know. You have to get it out of you. So even if you can't teach it to somebody else right away, talk to yourself. Talk to Hashem. Mm-hmm. Right? So those talk to yourself and talk to Hashem are two different practices, Musar practices or Hasidic practices, depending on how you want to call them. One is Hit Bonanut and one is Hit Bodedut. Hisbonanus or Hisbodidus.
What's the difference between talking to yourself and talking to Hashem?
One is talking to yourself, right? Why are there three different uses of the word nefesh? What could that possibly mean? Or why do I show up late to shul? What could that possibly mean? I wonder why I? That's talking to yourself. talking to God is, God, please help me assimilate this information. I want to be able to understand this. I want to be able to teach it. I want to be able to live it. Please, Hashem, help me integrate this into my soul, into my life. Please help me be a good teacher. Please help me say the right things. Please help me not say the wrong things. Please help me teach what the students that I'm teaching tonight need to hear. That's talking to God, right? But talking to yourself is, the end goal of my class is that I want to make sure that I clarify this point, and so I want to get from this point to that point, and so how am I going to do that? Right? So I might talk to myself in the car on the way down and talk to God before I get out of the car. Please help me teach it right. Right? So it's two different things. So hit bonenut is talking to yourself. And hit bodidut, his bodidus, is talking to God, being alone with God. So they're two different things, and both important. So if you can't teach a student the information, at least reteach it to yourself. That's important. And out loud, right? Or whispering. It's important to actually get it out of your mouth. So you can do it. A car is a great place to do it. Turn off the radio and talk to yourself a little bit, right? It's great because nobody knows if you're on your Bluetooth or not. You can just talk away. So, or when you're cleaning up the kitchen, whatever it is, if you're by yourself, then it's a good time to just talk to yourself a little bit about it. Okay. So here's two more things I want to read here. I don't think you have this page 139, so I'll read you this paragraph. All learning takes place within us. We can be taught and explained anything, from the simplest concept to the most difficult one, but understanding can only come from within. There's never a direct path between teacher and pupil whereby understanding is directly transferred. We are all familiar with the phenomenon of listening to someone explain a concept to us and not immediately grasping it. The words made sense, yet there was no understanding, until at one point things suddenly clicked. In truth, this process occurs within everything we learn. It's just that sometimes the understanding is almost instantaneous, while others we need a bit of processing time. The words you're reading right now must be processed within you, hopefully to be grasped from within. But without the inner dimension, they will remain just words with no resultant understanding. So that's what Musar really is the process of getting the words from the page to the brain to integrated knowledge into who you are. Right? So a lot of times we Jews think that learning is putting it into our brains. And it has to go a step further than that. So, and we do prize our brains. We're supposed to repeat it. We're supposed to live it. We're supposed to learn it enough that it's a part of us. So, and that's why sometimes a practice in Musar study might include reading and rereading a paragraph. Maybe 100 times. One paragraph. That can be a process of talking to yourself. Right? Of just bringing it deeper. And deeper and deeper, and contemplating the sentence in a different way each time you read it, trying to feel it in your mouth, to feel it in your mind, to feel the different places that it hits. Let's see, I do want to read this paragraph too on page 143. Students of Torah must be taught to spend time and invest energy into their questions. Ironically, one of the biggest dangers facing the student today is the myriad svarim available on every topic and on every level. Budding Torah scholars must be trained to struggle with their own questions and try and arrive at their own conclusions, only consulting svarim or rabbis, I'm adding parenthetically, after reaching their own answers and propositions. This constitutes a vital part of the independence demanded by Torah study. This is a challenge today, especially when we're not learning in Hebrew, when we're learning in English, and we just make the assumption that now that it's written in English, we have access to it. So we just read it, and then we have a question. Even if we get to a point where we learn how to develop a question, that's interesting, why does it say that? Quickly, your eyes drop to the commentary before you even fully develop the question. Mm-hmm. You're already looking for an answer, so you haven't even thought of the question. Right, and that's why one of the praises that a Rebbe will give to a student is, that's Rashi's question. Mm-hmm. Right? You want to get a student to come up with a question, and then you can compliment them by saying, Tosfos asks this question. And then, once you've developed the question, then you can start to look for an answer. But it's very important to develop a question, Because developing the question creates the space inside you where the answer can rest and become a part of you. If you don't dig the hole that the question creates, if you don't have the need for the answer, if you don't fully develop the question so that there's really now a yearning to know, what is this really? Then when you hear the answer, it can just slide right off you. So if you want it to become part of you, you have to get to a deeper question. So you may want to consider sometimes when you're learning, just reading, and sometimes stopping and saying a question out loud, working on developing a question. Then look at the commentary. But just take a little time to practice developing a question first. Okay, so I did want to go a little bit into Hanukkah. There's not so much time here, and I'm not going to be able to review. Oh, gosh, it's 8:20. Okay, so Hanukkah, the word Hanukkah, and I'm not going to go deeply into this. There's so many interesting things here. But the word Hanukkah means educate. It means dedicate, and it means educate. It's the same root as the word education. Chinuch is education, and Hanukkah is dedication. But chinuch really is the concept of dedicating a mind towards Torah. Chinuch, we say in this country, chinuch, right? Chinuch is not about just any education. You don't say, I'm going to college to get a good chinuch. And you're not mechanuch your children to whatever it is, some secular thing, right? You know, it's not chinuch to take piano lessons, although you're getting an education in something, but that's not chinuch. Chinuch is specifically Jewish education. Education in Jewish values, in Jewish concepts, in asking Jewish questions. That's what chinuch is. And that's what Hanukkah is. How do we dedicate a place? How do we dedicate a mind towards Torah, towards light, towards Hashem, towards connection? Really towards connection, if you think about it, because that's what the rededication of the temple was about, was... Well, the rededication of the temple was about rededicating that place for connection. It's a huge misunderstanding that people have, because it's just part of the children's stories today, that the temple was desecrated physically, that they went and messed it up. And when they took it back from the Greeks, they had to go through it and clean it up. They did not. The Greeks appreciated beautiful aesthetics. So they did not ransack the Holy Temple. They spiritually desecrated it. They offered sacrifices of pigs. They offered sacrifices to Zeus. They changed the whole spiritual structure of it. But physically, it was beautiful. And they offered sacrifices in the right place. They didn't make blood all over the place or ruin things or smash things at all.
That is the image I had.
Yes.
So they went to ransack it.
They did not, because their whole concept was... Think about this exile. The Greek exile was very unique. If we talk about four paradigmatic exiles, and Egypt doesn't count. Egypt is the first exile, but there's four main exiles in the history of the Jewish people. The first one is Babylon after the destruction of the first temple. Then that moves straight into the Persian Mede exile, the Purim story. The third one is the Greek exile, and the fourth one is the Roman exile, the one that we're in right now. These four exiles are alluded to in this verse that I have on the bottom of the page, Genesis 1:2. And the earth was, and I put the words in bold, the earth was null and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. This is not the Art Scroll translation, because the Art Scroll usually follows the King James translation. But in this case, it says astonishingly empty in Art Scroll, which doesn't work for this. Because it is important to see these as four different words. Null and void and darkness on the face of the deep. So null is the Babylonian exile. That's the exile in which the Babylonians tried to nullify our lives. They wanted to kill us, right? So they exiled us, but they wanted to nullify our connection to the land. They took us out, right? So they were nullifying our spiritual connection altogether. You can't, this is Tohu, right? Null. So they wanted to they took us out of our land. They severed us from our temple. And from our service, and they wanted us even to sing the songs. If you think about the Al Naharot Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon, we stepped down and wept. They wanted us to play our beautiful songs, but outside the temple, just for music's sake, not for connection's sake. They wanted to take away our connection, our spiritual connection, but they weren't killing us. The second one is void, death. That's the Persian Mede exile. That's the Purim story where they tried to kill us. So it wasn't about the spirituality. We actually separated our own selves spiritually. They started the separation, but then we continued the separation in the Persian Mede. That's a whole long poem story. But anyway, they tried to kill us. The third exile, well, let's go to the fourth for a second. The fourth exile is the Roman exile, the one that we're in now, where actually they have all three of these aspects. And I'll tell you what the third one is in just a minute. where they try to separate us from our spiritual source, where they try to kill us, where they try to, the third one is tamper with our minds, but I'll go into that in a minute, where they try to tamper with our minds. This fourth one, the Roman exiles, where they do all three to us, right? But the first, second, and fourth exiles are outside of our land. This third exile is unique. The third exile, the Greek exile, is the Hanukkah story. It's in our land with our temple still standing. What kind of exile is that? Really, it's an exile of our seichel. It's where our mind was darkened. And that's what the Greeks were about. That's why it's darkness on the face of the deep. The Greeks tried to darken our minds. They said, you could stay in your land. You could have your temple. Just do our service in the temple. We're not saying don't be spiritual. There's a lot of fabulous spiritual things. Just mix your spiritual in with our spiritual. Be part of us. Make it be beautiful. So they darkened our eyes. They darkened our ability to see that the Jews' spirituality is qualitatively different than their spirituality. They're about beauty in the Greeks and Western society. That's why the ballet, it's not tzedakah, but why in Western society, based on Greco-Roman society, because it's based on Greco-Roman and Judeo-Christian values, in Greco-Roman-based Western society, ballet is tzedakah because it's beautiful. And culture in a city is vital. We need a symphony. We need public art. We need a ballet troupe. We need theater. This is what gives us life and vibrancy as a city. Denver wouldn't be a solid city without these cultural institutions. So please, give your charity money to these institutions. That's the Greco-Roman voice in Western society, right? That is charity because that is something that brings this society good. But the Jewish value is not nature, but above nature. Our contribution is above nature. We live in miracles. That's who we are. Are we bound by nature? We're not. And we start that right away with the Bris Milah and say, this thing that's so natural, that could lead you so astray, that also connects generation to generation, this needs to be channeled. And we're going to make a mark on here that says, channel this energy and live above nature. You can do miracles with this, bring life into the world. But it's not just through nature. It's through everything that you do. So, and you can bring Kedusha and Tahara through this, or you can bring the exact opposite through this.
Why did all these exiles, why did they want to do that to us? I mean, what?
Excellent question. I'll just give you a quick answer. So the question is, why did everybody want to annihilate us? So our sages say that when God gave us the Torah on Har Sinai, Sina entered the world. Har Sinai, Mount Sinai. Sina, hatred. It's actually spelled differently. One's spelled with the Samach, one's spelled with the Sin. However, they sound similar, right? When the Torah was given on Har Sinai, Sina came to the Jews. Why? Hitler, unfortunately, figured it out. He said that the Jews committed two sins against humanity. Two blemishes. The Jews put two blemishes on humanity. I'm paraphrasing. Put two blemishes on humanity. Circumcision on the flesh and conscience on the soul. And that's why Sina came to the Jews. The Jews stand. That's our job. The Jews stand for morality. The Jews stand for control. The Jews stand for proactive interaction with things for positive purpose. If you just want to do nothing, or if you just want to feed your physical in whatever way that is, you want to steal money, you want to just eat yummy foods, you want to just whatever, or take lives, or conquer the whole world. So this is not acceptable. And the Torah comes to teach that's not okay. And God came to choose a people to teach the world that it's not okay. So even if we're not living correctly, everybody in the world really knows. Everybody who knows the Torah story, so that's Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and now because of Christian missionaries, many more peoples as well have heard this story, that there's God, he spoke to human beings, and he gave human beings a book, and the book says what to do in the world, right? Everybody who's heard that story knows it's the Jews that got the book. The Jews spoke to God, the Jews were the messengers for teaching the world how to be. That's why the Christians want to convert a Jew more than they want to convert anybody else. Do we have a big problem with Christians converting Buddhists? We don't, right? We don't have, right? Buddhists for Buddhists or whatever. Like we don't have that. The problem that the Christians want a Jew more than anybody else because the Jews heard God speak and they got the Torah. And there is one people that was chosen. Everybody agrees there's a chosen people. The question just is, who is the chosen people? Is it the Christians, the Muslims, or the Jews? All three of them know, first it was the Jews, then the Christians say, but they dropped the ball. And so now it was passed on to us, the Christians. Right? The Muslims say they blew it. They actually lost the whole Torah, so God had to re-reveal it in the Quran to Muhammad. So now it's us, right? But nobody says there's not a chosen people, and they just wonder who it is. But everybody actually knows it's the Jews. Speak what they want. They know it's the Jews. My son last week had surgery and a dentist appointment, and two different nurses in two different offices saw his yarmulke and said, I love you people. You're such smart people. And he said, you know, it's racist, but I love it. So that's nice. And they two different people say, I love you people. So, you know, what is the you people? But it is a you people. That's the truth. We're not the same as other people. And everybody knows it. And the only people who don't know it are Jews. It's true. I mean, everybody else knows it. You ask a Christian, they know it. We're different. That's why they could love you people. Who says you people about Christians? There's no you people with Christians, and there's no you people with Jews either. We come in every stripe, from every color, from every country, from every culture. No you people, except for there is a you people, because we're Jews. And we are united in that. There's no getting out of that. So why do they hate us? Because we are the conscience of humanity. We do bring a message into the world that there's a way to behave. And you can't get out from under it. And you can't even kill us all and get out from under it. It's not possible to kill us all. But that's why you'd want to. Because we're in your way. You know, we say there's a way to behave. And you're not interested. Not interested. So the darkness that the Greeks put over the Jewish eyes was sechel. They darkened our sechel. Which is why the miracle of oil is the miracle that we celebrate. Really the miracle for Hanukkah was a military victory. Not a spiritual victory. But it was a spiritual victory. Because the military war was about which paradigm will win out here among the Jews. The we go by nature paradigm or we go by miracles paradigm. We go by above nature paradigm. Of course, we don't rely on miracles, but we understand that we have to live above nature. Mm-hmm. So which paradigm will win? We won the war, but you could always say we were just good tacticians, right? Yes, we didn't have all the things we needed to win the war, but we did win the war. So you never know, was that a miracle or not? So, but it was a miracle. So the way God showed it was a miracle was through the miracle of the oil. What was that, finding that flask of oil? We didn't even have a concept of the flask of oil ever being stamped by the Kohen Gadol. So it's not like we were looking for a flask of oil with a stamp from the Kohen Gadol. This wasn't a thing. But we didn't want to light with any old oil. And we could have lit with any old oil. Because everybody was tamei meit. Everybody had experienced war. Everybody had the tumah of death attached to them. They all had to wait 7 days before they produced oil on the eighth day. And they could have lit with any oil during those 7 days, but they didn't want to. Why? Because oil represents sechel. In Jewish teaching, oil is sechel. Oil is the mind, is Jewish wisdom. What they were looking for was one flask of untainted Jewish wisdom. One piece of us that hadn't been tainted by Hellenism. One little bit of Jewish wisdom that could light up the world with the menorah in a pure way. And that's really what the miracle of Hanukkah is that we even bother to look for it. We know there is something about Jewish wisdom that is so pure and so special, that it's so powerful it can light up the whole world with just a tiny little flame. Because look at what we Jews are doing to the world. Look at the little bit of Jewish wisdom. How tiny are we? We're a beansy-weensy little nation. And yet our flame lights up the whole world. And we're not there yet. The whole world's not burning brightly yet. But it will, because eventually we will conquer through ideas. Through ideas. Through ideas of world peace. And
I get a kick out of the score on Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
Between Jews and Muslims.
Right.
So 12 million of us, 126 Nobel Prizes, 3 billion of them, or something like that, and six Nobel
Prizes. And one went to Arafat, and one went to a Christian.
Yeah.
Muslim, not a Muslim, an Arab Christian. So, four to Muslims. So, really.
Remarkable statistics.
It is. So we're not just talking about smarts here, but we are talking about how Jews affect the world through our sechel. Mm-hmm. So we definitely can affect it. We can just be intellectual if we want and just get Nobel Prizes in chemistry. That's fabulous. But we really have a seichel that's so much more than chemistry and so much more than physics. It's how do we transform the world into a place where we all work together in synergy. And that's really the miracle of Hanukkah, is that the Jews understood there's something special about Jewish wisdom, and it can light up the whole world. And with a tiny little bit, you can do a lot. And that's really the message of this class, this series, the message of Hanukkah, the message of this series, and the message of Musar is, you might not think you're a lot, but you can do a lot. And whatever you have inside you, a tiny little bit, you can do a lot. You're a Jewish child of God. Every human being is a child of God. But as a Jew, we have a potential to accomplish a lot. Even if we're just a little, we can do a lot. So that's what we're tasked with, is to look inside, find our little, and make it a lot. Okay, that's the end of the series.